April 18th, Los Angeles, at the AE meeting. You were just talking about the influence of the Navy on endodontics and its importance. Why don't you go into that story a little bit?
The history of specialization, there was a very strong resistance on the part of the average dentist to take a negative attitude towards any additional specialties. It so happened that I touched on this morning, I've got some of this data, and I want to see if I can't just maybe document something here that I think has significance. The first specialty that was approved in 1947, that was oral surgery. And in 1948, you had pedodontics, periodontics, and prostodontics in that particular year. 1950, orthodontics and oral pathology. In 51, public health dentistry. And then there was a hiatus. There was a strong moratorium pressure problem that they had at one time as many as 33 groups seeking special identification. In that interim from 1951 to 1980, the only field that was recognized was endodontics. The board initially was developed as a committee within the structure of the AAE about 10 years after its formation. Its formation in 1943, or a group of about, I think, 19 to 23 people who met in Chicago. You may have this information from some other source. And about within the decade, they appointed a committee to look into the possibility of developing a specialty group. I think had they moved earlier, they might not have had the problem of recognition. But as the thing dragged on, and there was some feeling within the organization itself that specialty status was not desirable.
What do you attribute that to?
I think because a lot of the men were structured in general dentistry who were doing endodontics and felt that especially would dilute maybe their identification as a practitioner. I think there was a strong feeling throughout the country for years that endodontics was not a therapy of virtue, that there was a great reaction following the focal infection concept, which was readily accepted by both the medical and dental professions. Had permeated the concept of the public insofar as what a diseased tooth might create in the broad health arena, that there was a rejection, that you had to be adventurous in those days as a practitioner, as were the men that started the endodontic group. I don't know how many specialists there were in 43. I know prior to that time, the only limited practitioner in the world was Harry B. Johnson in Atlanta, Georgia. There may have been some others, but most of these men were relatively old men even in those days. Edgar Coolidge, George Sharp from Pasadena, Coolidge from Chicago. You had the Sama, the Michigan complex. You had the Grossman complex in Pennsylvania. And the Michigan Penn groups were, in essence, the fountainheads of the educational sources. Even one of the earlier founders, Davis, Clyde Davis, the first president of AAE, was an educator from, I think, Iowa, who wrote a book called Operative Dentistry. Of course, at that time, the strong feeling that this was an entity of operative dentistry. And it stayed that way for many, many years, and it's still so in some of the schools, like Alabama, for instance. It's a part of a department rather than a separate department. Well, Davis' book on operative dentistry, even in the revised edition, had like 126 pages devoted to endodontics, almost all of the delineations of endodontics. Pulpotomy, root-end procedures, reverse procedures. But this was sort of a narrow, small enclave within one geographical area in the country. There was very little communication within the discipline nationally. There was very little communication because transportation was difficult. Some of the men knew each other in small areas, and essentially education was controlled by the oral surgeon prosthodontic leaders who controlled both dental education and dental organization.
Now, where were you involved in this?
I think I may be involved more by accident than by intent. I was interested in endodontics. I studied with Harry B. Johnson. I was a student of his in Atlanta. He was an extremely impressive member of the faculty to us, and he was an achieving individual from a standpoint that his dedication carried him in the face of being indicted as a therapy of vice. Never forget, one of the eminent, prominent, highly competent oral surgeons on the podium of a lecture made a statement. He had paved the driveway of his home with the money that he had made, extracting the teeth that Harry B. Johnson had saved. It was a humorous remark whose connotation was ugly in concept, and a very thoughtless thing. Johnson was an extremely religious man. He was religious to the point of tithing. He was religious to the point that he lived the religious life, practiced it. His wife was almost evangelical in her zeal, to the point that she wanted to evangelize everybody she saw. But I would say, as a human being, regardless of what his beliefs were, that he was a man of eminent character and quality and practice likewise, a very giving man to people who wanted to come and learn from him. He would spend the time, he would open up his offices and shared his knowledge and his feelings and his beliefs. And I think, in a way, developed from his own personality and contribution a whole cadre or a legion of people in the southeastern part of the United States who have perpetuated and carried on, to some extent, his philosophy of conserving natural teeth through endodontic therapy. His dedication also carried him. He would get on a train, go all the way to California, spend days on end traveling there to share his view and his concept and his technique, and part of his concept and technique really maintained itself in Southern California and still has. Paul Hill, George Sharp, also in the New York area. One of the earlier figures in endodontics, a fellow named M.L. Ryan, who was the first dentist to demonstrate measurement of a root canal by the use of x-ray. And M.L. Ryan had a series of film clips that he had done in 24 millimeter film that is an historic reference to endodontics, and I have that. I had that made into a 16 millimeter movie. And M.L. Ryan was associated with E.G. Van Vale, who was the second president of AAE, whose son, E.C. Van Vale, practices general dentistry in New York today. And he had this film clip material, which I took and had it transposed into a 16 millimeter film. And it shows, in essence, how they did root canal therapy by a motion picture hand crank unit. And there is very little new and conceptual technique on the rubber dam, the aseptic technique, thorough-instrumentation, biomechanical cleansing, and filling the canal. At this time, they were using what they call the button concept, where they wanted to overfill. Of course, in the use of chloroform as a solvent with the gutta percha, by overfilling, knowing that chloroform had a high shrinkage potential, that as the gutta percha shrank, that it would compensate the shrinkage by pulling in the button of excess gutta percha and apex. It was a theory. It was a concept. It proved to be not accurate. But it was one of the procedures that was initiated. And I would say it was sophisticated in its application by Harry B. Johnson, who took the Callahan concept. Callahan was the one who developed the gutta percha use in root canal therapy. Johnson perfected it, and that became known as the Johnson-Callahan technique. And this was the filling material that Nigar Ospe got his PhD degree on and demonstrated, of all of the procedures used for filling a root canal, this was the only one that was biologically acceptable, published in 1939.
Can you tell me something about Dr. Ostie. Some people have said that he was more motivated to sell his products than to promote endodontics.
That is, in every aspect, untrue, false, defamatory, and inexcusable. And I have heard that too. Ostie was a Norwegian, finished dental school, Royal College, Royal Dental College in Oslo. Achieved a PhD degree doing his study of all the materials used in endodontics. He devised in his study a method of removing intact the apical part of the tooth within the anatomy of the individual, so that he got a clear-cut histological section of the root, the supporting tissue, and the supporting bone all in one section. Prior to that time, in doing biologic studies, they would extract a tooth. There's no way you can extract a tooth without having a contamination. Well, any gingival crevice of any human being that is viable is contaminated. In Norway, they were able to use human specimens through the Marine Hospital. They paid these men for being part of an experiment, gave them free dentistry and also a stipend in order to provide this particular resource. When he published his study, it was in 1939, the monograph. The monograph was sent to several of the more astute individuals in this country who received it, shelved it, never read it, never mentioned it, never discussed it. In the interim, Norway developed an Institute of Dental Research, which was in a house. Go ahead.
May I interrupt you for just a minute? Why do you attribute this? What motivated these people?
Well, you're having me pass judgment on people's behavior. I don't want to do that.
Okay.
Subsequently, he became a director of the Institute of Dental Research in Norway, which was funded by the profits from a football pool in Norway. And the profits from that pool was devoted to medical and dental research. And he developed it, Norwegian Institute of Dental Research in Oslo in a house that was, I would say, less than luxurious. To go from the first floor downstairs, you had to walk out of the building to even get downstairs. And in this little enclave, he developed a research center whose contributions to the field of endodontics, both in its basic and clinical sciences, has probably been as significant, if not more so, than any other one resource in the world, without exception. Plus the fact that he documented the biological significance of endodontic therapy. Up until that time, it had been empirical. Many, many techniques have been used. Almost any technique that had been used could demonstrate some manifestation of success. But he was able to demonstrate success in failure, cause of failure, and the biological tolerance of those materials that was used insofar as the biological mechanism was concerned, both within the tooth and that which had been extruded in the supporting tissue. And that probably was a landmark decision, a landmark finding, and really complemented all of the work that had been done to justify this particular therapy as being biologically and scientifically acceptable. He was the man who first did it. The indictment that has been attributed to him came about because he had developed several items for endodontic therapy. One was he developed a frame which was radiographic translucent. Prior to that time, they used metallic frames which impeded or obliterated anatomical areas where x-rays were used, which was cumbersome. And you took the thing down, and in some schools took down the whole mechanism of the dam to take an x-ray, which opened up a whole new Pandora's box of contamination. But in order not to have one defect, they in turn created a second defect, potentially. So he created the frame in conjunction with DuPont when nylon first came out. He also developed a method by which you could measure root length. He also developed a material which had been used in chloropercha, which was the Johnson-Callahan technique. He devised a formula that could be used prepared a proprietary item which he manufactured. The thing that's not understood in this country is that the criteria we use here for the principles of ethics apply only to the American Dental Association. That men who do other things in other countries fulfill the ethical code of their countries, not necessarily consistent with the ADA. But people have a tendency to use their yardstick to measure other people in other cultures, and this is an indictment that's unfortunate, and it's not accurate.
In your personal evaluation, then, he was a man of high ethical, he wasn't ethical.
Nigel Ospe, historically, was probably the most significant one contributor to the concept of the science of endodontics than anyone living or dead in the history of the world.
And that's what you feel?
I think this is easily documented. Mm-hmm. From a standpoint of endodontics in its present status in this country today, its recognition from this fountainhead of America to the world around, I would say maybe Louis Grossman. He's probably the best-known name in dentistry in the world, and probably by dint of his own enthusiasm, determination, stubbornness, persistence, probably more than anyone else, was able to generate the interest and level that endodontics achieved. And in that sense, I'd say there's no one who has contributed in this aspect as much as Louis Grossman has. That, I would say, is true. But as far as basic fundamental research and substance, that Nigel Ospe would rank number one in the history of dentistry. His criticisms I've heard. A lot of people don't understand that in the interim of the 30s and the 40s and the war years, the hardships that really were imposed upon some areas of the world, more especially Norway, where economics was at a very low ebb, and directly after the war, I'll never forget, I met him in Holland, we were both on the program. He didn't have enough money in his pocket when he got off the plane to buy a meal. There was such a restriction on currency. So there was a pressure for these people to generate some type of economic resources, because they were literally dollar-wise or money-wise economically desperate. He did commercialize his products. They're available in this country, distributed by ethical institutions. An example, Star Dental was one, ethical dealer as far as I know, hygienic people, also I think an ethical company here, who couldn't afford to be identified with an ethical resource. Ospe, by the same token, is a member, he's a member of the American College of Dentists, of whom damn few foreigners ever come in to be accepted. He's not a political dentist. He wasn't brought in because he was international president of something. He was brought in because of his reputation as an endodontist and as a dentist, as an international figure of note. He was an honorary member of the American Association of Endodontists, who would never have endorsed a man of unethical conduct. He's been on the podium of almost every major educational institution in North America, forget the world. But he's been on the podium in Michigan, Emory, he's been on American Dental Association program. He's been on the program of the Hinman, he's been on a New York program. He's been in Southern California, the University of Washington, been at Pennsylvania many times. He's been on a New York program. Been on U.S. North Carolina programs. I can't even think of all the schools in which he has been invited to lecture. I brought him here 17 times, primarily for lecture programs. He's been an invited participant in the workshops on dental education by the AAE that was monitored with and worked with the Council on Dental Education, American Dental Association, and to taint him with commercialism is to abuse a man without substance. It's easy to be a critic, especially when you have no responsibility in your judgment. And I would say that that's an ugly, unnecessary attribution, which has no basis in fact. His genesis here, I think, is very interesting. I was somewhat annoyed when I first met him. I met him in 1953 at the International Conference University of Pennsylvania. And I was one of the recallers, I think, of that particular conference. Lou Grossman had been in London the previous year and was one of the speakers, reporter, co-reporter on International Endowment Conference in London. I don't know who put that together, but Osprey was invited to speak there, and I think for the first time, Lou heard Osprey and invited Osprey to Pennsylvania at the first International Conference in 1953. Now, on that meeting, he had Dr. Pucci from Montevideo, who wrote the very classic textbook on dental anatomy. He had Stuart Ross, who was an Englishman. He had Ralph Sommer from the University of Michigan. He had Darrell Ostrander from Michigan. I was trying to think of the people who were there on the program, I don't remember right now. But Margarita Marzabal from Argentina. He had Appleton there, who had been a dean of University of Pennsylvania and was a rather well-known microbiologist. Initially worked on some of the sterilization procedures in endodontics. It was a very significant meeting, and Osprey electrified that particular session. Most people who went to that meeting will remember that Osprey was there more than anyone else. He created such a response, such a dramatic, dynamic impact by merely reporting material from his 1939 thesis. The annoyance some of us had, who were really not that sophisticated or that well structured within the group, was here was a man who had been here twice before with the material in his suitcase. Nobody asked him to show it. I asked him one question about the work that he had done. In the same sensitivity that had directed him, the fact that he was insensitive about his ethical behavior, he still had the self-dignity not to volunteer to be a speaker. So I'd say to some extent that dilutes some of the criticisms of the man. When he's invited to speak in 53, he was almost exhilarated by the response, and Ralph Sommer, Darrell Ostrander, Lou Grossman, and the whole cadre of the real honchos and endodontics really picked him up and made him a king in image. He had a delightful sense of humor. He spoke very well. His material was highly organized. His presentation was beautiful, and his work answered so many of the questions that had been historically posed, why this or why that. He had the answers. This is 53. Now you go back 14 years, and assuming the hiatus of the war years, that things sort of were dormant. But here's a man who had accomplished something historic, and yet even the educators, and I don't make any bones about saying that I fault the Ostranders and the Sommers and the Grossmans and the others. Never read his paper. Now, it may be that it was published in German. Now, Lou Grossman reads German fluently. I'm sure Ralph Sommer didn't, and some of the others. Subsequently, the Norwegian Institute of Dental Research published his papers in English. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I'm very glad that you had the opportunity to set some records straight, because that's your influence in endodontics and in the society. Would you comment on that?
My influence?
Yeah.
I'm not aware that I have any influence in endodontics. I certainly have visible manifestations of interest, but as far as influence, I wouldn't be able to identify any interest that I have. Mm-hmm. Influence? That's a rather porous word, a fluid. I don't know what you mean by influence.
Well, in terms of policy making and the decisions that were made by the AE and direction and where they were going to go,
I don't think I'm qualified. I think a more objective response might be better. I don't think I'm the one who needs to make that evaluation. I might respond to that tangentially. There's an excitement to endodontics to me. Someone once asked me why I was an endodontist. And I said, I dare say the biggest reason was I couldn't make a good denture. I made a denture for my daddy. And he's passed away some years ago, but that's been one of the deep, profound regrets in my whole soul, that what I did for him was a minus, not a plus. I was trained in a school that was essentially a replacement school. Very few of my teachers spoke elementary English very well. It was a trade school, it was a proprietary school. I don't know how I can articulate this for you. I finished school in 1936. After graduation, I would say that I was in a state of marginal depression. I'm speaking not altogether from an emotional reference, but in what the devil I was going to do with my life, having finished dental school, because so much of dentistry absolutely did not interest me. I didn't want to pull people's teeth. I didn't necessarily want to make dentures. The cultural structure of dentistry and the society in which we live, you met a lot of young people for whom you work, and as they grew older and you grew older, you ended up making dentures for the patients whose teeth you couldn't salvage. I went, took some time and went up east and in the Midwest and met some people and realized the horizons of my education were rather stilted and limited, and there were magnificent horizons elsewhere I'd never even heard about. Everybody in the school used to always tell us how great we were. And when a teacher tells you how great thou art, you tend to believe him, as you believe everything else. It's only after you're out of school you realize that most progress is made by very sophisticated art of doubt rather than general acceptance. That moved me to some extent, that there was more to dentistry than that I'd been taught. I was impressed with some of the things I saw at Eastman. I was impressed with some of the things that I saw at Columbia that time when Dean Rapalje was there. I was impressed with what they were doing at Michigan with the John Cousins, with the Fund Memorial, the Cousins Fund Memorial. things that I'd never heard about. Maybe I was not knowledge I could have maybe read or looked at the literature, but this somewhat wasn't the things that we were taught to do, and we didn't know about them. But that, more than anything else, I think expanded my horizons. To me, demonstrated the fact that maybe there was something in dentistry that would capture my imagination. I really spent a fair amount of time that summer deciding not to practice dentistry. I thought I'd go to medical school. The fact that I didn't, I think, was a great decision for me, because I don't think temperamentally or emotionally that being a physician is within my scope of tolerance. I don't believe I could handle gracefully the problems of life and death. When I realized how I agonized over losing a tooth, and you multiply that dimension by losing a patient, I don't know if I could handle it too well. So I think maybe more by coincidence than by intent, I found a niche in dentistry that attracted my curiosity and my interest, and I feel I've survived in that degree of satisfaction that I find gratifying. And when I started practicing, this was the area in which I was interested. I practiced 25 years and never made a denture. I always made a good living. I didn't have to make dentures. During the war years, I practiced over 3 years and was called to the service before the war started. I was sent to a general hospital. I had some military status. And sent me to a general hospital. It was sort of a select area of assignment. And nobody there wanted to do endodontics, but I did. So I did it. I did endodontics in Europe in the field with a foot engine under the trees and no x-ray. I wouldn't say that was dramatic, but the idea of pulling teeth out, maybe necessity that somebody said was the mother of invention. Might not have been done too well, but at least I made the effort of doing it. And I think that in a way it gave me an inner satisfaction. One of the few things in life that's not taxable. I also had a problem when I was in one of the campaigns across the Rhine early part of the war, developed a tooth that had a problem. I went to one of the general hospitals, just moved into the area. It was the Indiana unit. And I had a lateral incisor, which I knew had become pulpless. And I couldn't get anybody to do it for me. So I got one dentist to whom I promised two German swords with swastikas on them.
And you put a I'm sorry. Go ahead. That noise is really...
I gave him two swastika swords, and he did it. And I sat there for 3.5 hours for him to do this lateral incision, which I still have. We did that in 1945, I think in March. It was a week before Roosevelt died. I happen to remember. I still have the tooth. I'm sure my endodontics is comparable to his. So at least I can say that my philosophy has a personal attachment to it. Subsequent to the war, and you know, the endodontics started in 1943 when most of us at my age level went to service. And the charter members were people who had not been in the option, not in the military, because they weren't available. I don't remember when I joined the endodontic group, but I came up here maybe in the 40s and joined. And that was interesting too, because I was the main speaker today at the new members' breakfast, and I started to comment on my experience as a new member. I think I dropped dead in the hallway by the room where the endodontics would meet. They'd walked around me or over me. I don't think they stopped to wonder who it was on the ground. Perhaps they paid no attention to me. That influenced me some later on to see that new members at least got the recognition of being identified. Well, one of the earlier lectures I heard was Don Kerr from the University of Michigan explaining periapical lesions and the rationale. And that was an excitement about it. Coming from the South, from a fairly small town, the stimulation, the intercommunication stimulation, the desire was somewhat restricted and limited. The University of North Carolina didn't have a dental school until 1950. And the first graduate class 1954, and at that time that school hadn't achieved too much of an area of things that had any fascination for me. So I was really very little identified in one reference with the school in the earlier years. But I'd say that the endodontic group and the people in the group, they were benevolent when you got to know them, they were generous, they were giving, and from this group I developed a very strong friendship with people. That's probably the most meaningful thing in my life, and I've enjoyed it. May have been an adult.